Hey, y'all, Scott here. Support my sponsors. The War State by Michael Swanson, a great book about the Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy years and the rise of the military-industrial complex, the permanent war system in America. The War State by Mike Swanson. And he also gives great investment advice and stock market analysis and so forth at wallstreetwindow.com. Sign up for his great email list there and learn all about what's going on in the markets at wallstreetwindow.com, libertystickers.com. I made up most of them, at least used to be most of them. Libertystickers.com and thebumpersticker.com. They'll do work for you if you need some stickers printed there. All right, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. For you libertarians, you want to protect your savings, you buy some precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, whatever you need, is there at Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc., RBI.co. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Check out the full archives of my interviews at scotthorton.org, almost 4,500 of them now, going back to 2003. And check out the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. And I apologize in advance for how I talk to you on Twitter. I'm a terrible person. Okay. Introducing our good friend, Bob Murphy. He is from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, a senior fellow there, and he keeps his own website, Free Advice, at consultingbyrpm.com. And here he is, research assistant professor at the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech University. You're a Texan now. Welcome back to the show, Bob. How's it going?
Hey, Scott. Glad to be here. Things are great.
That's cool, man. I'm glad you're in Texas. Seems like you used to live far away in some Yankee state like Tennessee or something, right?
Well, I was born in New York, so that was worse, right? Oh, but then, yeah. Tennessee for a while, and yes, now I've been in Texas coming up on 2 years.
I know that might make the Tennessee folk mad, but they are Yankees compared to a Texan, you know, way down here. Anyway. Hey, man, so I want to ask you questions about, you know, the economy and stuff like that.
Okay, sure thing. Yeah, and this healthcare reform or health insurance reform stuff too, there's a lot that I think the narrative people are hearing is completely distorted. You will be shocked to hear.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I don't even know anything about the narrative because I'm trying to wrap up this book about Afghanistan. I'm not even keeping up with Syria news very well anymore. So first of all, I guess what we all know is Obama passed Obamacare and now the Republicans are doing something about that. So you pick up the question from there, wherever you want to go.
Okay, sure. Yeah, sure thing. And so by no means with a lot of this stuff, you know, it might come off like I'm defending Trump or the Republican. And I'm not. It's just the way the Democrats are attacking them is completely dishonest. And it leads people to believe in the efficacy of bigger government. So that's the purpose of me trying to correct this narrative. So Obamacare, you know, the Affordable Care Act, that was falling apart. Major insurers were losing millions of dollars. They were pulling out. And so that was not a sustainable system. And so then now the Republicans are coming along. Trump completely made promises that were impossible to keep during the campaign. And I think that's clearly a case where he literally just didn't even know enough about it. And so he was saying, oh, yeah, we'll keep it. You know, we'll keep everybody's universal coverage and we're just going to make it better and cheaper. I think he had this notion that, oh, well, I'll just get in there with my guys and we'll look at it and we'll find some cost savings and how hard can it be? Right. And he really didn't know what he was even talking about. So clearly, you know, I'll stipulate all that. But in particular, the one thing if your listeners get nothing else out of this that I want to make sure they understand is the way the Democrats now are complaining about the Republicans' proposals to reform or overhaul or repeal and replace, depending on who you're catering to, Obamacare, is they're saying this bill is going to literally kill people. And they'll come up with estimates as to how many people are going to literally die because of partially, you know, taking away the effects of Obamacare. So on that, Orrin Cass from the Manhattan Institute has a fantastic takedown of that claim. And so just make sure your listeners get this. If you look at the actual mortality data, right? So this isn't theoretical. You can go and look and see, okay, how many people died, you know, in the U.S. before Obamacare and after, and the provisions fully kicked in 2014, and you can look, and mortality rates adjusting for age and everything, you know, this is the way like official government figures and stuff, this isn't, you know, some right-wing think tank's numbers, these are the standard numbers, mortality rates went up And furthermore, you can say, all right, and Oren says, okay, now maybe that's not because of Obamacare. That could have been, you know, opioid epidemic or whatever. So let's be fair. If you break down the numbers and look at the states that expanded Medicaid coverage, because you may, I don't know if this was on your radar, Scott, but that was one of the controversies, is that like the Republican states with governors, some of them refused to accept the Medicaid expansion that was, you know, an option under the Affordable Care Act, whereas other states were like, oh yeah, we'll take your money and go ahead and expand Medicaid. So if anything, you know, clearly the mechanism by which Obamacare was supposed to help people was by expanding Medicaid coverage. That was primarily why so many people were, you know, got insurance who didn't have it before. The states that expanded Medicaid coverage had a worse, you know, effect on their mortality rates than the states that refused to do so. Okay, so again, in overall absolute terms, mortality reversed. Normally, mortality gets better year after year. Now, all of a sudden, it flipped when Obamacare fully kicks in nationwide. And then again, if you break it down by states, the ones that took the money and expanded their Medicaid coverage had worse mortality outcomes relative to the states that didn't. So,
all right, well, wait a minute. Let me stop right there for just a sec to say that, you know, damn lies and statistics and all this kind of stuff. So it does seem counterintuitive if the poorest people who absolutely could not get insurance, all of a sudden now they can go see their doctor, but it's a Medicaid doctor, so they kill them? Or what? What's the cause and effect there?
Let me come to that in a second, but let me just say one thing on this work, because you're right, Scott. So I was skeptical myself, and so I wanted to see, well, what does the other side say? You know, people who are for the Affordable Care Act, how do they? And so I'm looking at this thing from the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is totally pro ACA. They've been there for years, and they have a study, same sort of thing. And this is, you know, the whole point of this study is to say how great the ACA was, and they talk about key findings, and they say how coverage went up across, you know, vulnerable groups. And then they have a bullet point called access to care, utilization, affordability, and health outcomes. So I thought, okay, here's where we're going to get into. I want to see, do they agree with? So they say, most research demonstrates that Medicaid expansion positively impacts access to care, utilization of services, affordability of care, and financial security among low-income population. Okay, so those are all about, you know, getting insurance, financial security. Okay, but technically that doesn't say whether their health went up or down. And then here's the one sentence they had. This is in their executive summary. Studies have also shown improved self-reported health following expansion, but additional research is needed to determine effects on health outcomes. Okay, so even the pro-ACA thing, the evidence they gave was to say, yeah, if you survey people and say, how did you think you're better off? And they'll say yes, but they don't actually have any hard numbers. So to answer your question, Scott, I haven't delved into the numbers enough to know whether it's saying the people who didn't have insurance before now get it are worse off, or it's saying among the population as a whole in this state, mm-hmm. if you start giving care to some with strained resources, does that reduce, you know, the overall efficacy? So people who had it before now get worse. See what I'm saying? So it's not saying the people who are getting insurance necessarily worse off. It's just saying the states that expanded Medicaid coverage, mortality in that state went up relative to states that didn't.
All right. Now, there could be other reasons involved too, right? The opiates or whatever, different variables that aren't necessarily being taken into account or what? Well, and also there's subsidized coverage, not just Medicaid. There are a lot of people who have cheaper insurance now who are also then flooding the market as consumers, and there are not enough doctors kind of thing. Is that something you're thinking
of? Well, right. So the two things you brought there, one, again, I realize it's, you know, it's kind of like saying, you know, if the government comes along and starts handing out food or something, and then, you know, more people are starving. Like, you know, as a libertarian or something, you might object to the principle of redistribution of income, but that seems counterintuitive. You hand out more food. But on the other hand, you say, well, is it really so implausible to say if, you know, government schooling actually makes people less educated, especially the longer you let that system run? And then I say, oh, I don't know. And, you know, the VA hospitals, that's government-run healthcare. Do, you know, is it so counterintuitive to think that's actually hurting people to put them through that system? The one thing too about the opioids and all that, again, just make sure though you get that could explain why, you know, mortality went up in the nation as a whole, reversing a decades long trend, because that crisis happened to hit just when Obamacare happened to kick in, and it's not really Obamacare's fault. But what would be kind of odd is that the opioid crisis hits more heavily just in the states that expanded Medicaid coverage and not so much in the other states. You know, that's actually kind of like the opposite of the standard narrative, that it's the opioids crisis places that we're all rednecks voting for Trump.
So is it pretty much obvious then that the problem here is you have all new patients, but you don't have a correlated expansion of doctors and nurses and healthcare companies to take care of them. So people are dying in the waiting room. Is that it?
I think that could be part of it. So I confess, Scott, you're right. I haven't, you know, I'm just right now diving into this literature and stuff. So I don't have, I first want to make sure the numbers are right and everything. And like I said, my first line of defense was to go look at the other side to see, you know, are they saying different numbers? And so far they haven't, they've just been saying different things. Like, well, if you ask people, are you healthier? They say yes. You know, that kind of stuff.
Well, and just like with anything, correlations can hide causations. You know, not only might they not be necessarily related in the way you think, but it might be the opposite of that you find out later, right?
Sure. But again, though, I'm just saying for the people who are claiming, because there's a lot of people, a lot of studies that were coming out saying, statistical analysis claims that the Affordable Care Act saved anywhere from, you know, such and such thousand per this thousand lives per year. And so, a lot of people who are following this thought like, oh, no, they proved it. And when you go and look at those studies, the methodology behind them, it was things like they looked at prior studies like the expansion of health insurance under Romney Care and then looked at how much coverage went up under Obamacare and just assumed that that trend followed through. Right. Whereas but the actual mortality data was different. So you're totally right, Scott. I mean, there's all kinds of moving parts with these things, but I'm just saying prima facie mortality rates went up exactly when Obamacare fully kicked in. And even if you break it down by the states that, in a sense, more took advantage of Obamacare than the states that didn't, if anything, the outcome was the opposite. So people who are like, you know, accusing their critics of denying science and not being empirical, I'm saying the burden of proof is on them. And just, you know, among libertarians, again, is that really so shocking to think the government gets more involved in healthcare and the average health outcome goes down? So as far as the mechanism, I think you're right, Scott, that may be partly what it is. It's like if the government just declared, hey, everybody who wants to get a new car, go ahead. If you just show up at a dealership, whether you have the money to afford it or not, the dealership now has to give you a new car. And, you know, it's illegal for them to turn you down. It wouldn't be shocking that several years into that system, the quality of cars produced would go down. Some people would get cars who didn't have them before and they would be better off. But in terms of would that really help the car market nationally, I think just passing that mandate and saying, nope, car dealerships have to give you a car whether you can pay for it or not, that would screw everything up. And I think that's what we're seeing here.
Right. All right. So now the Republican bill, they're not libertarians, and I want to ask you about, you know, your libertarian world and how you think things should work in a minute, but what about these conservative SOBs over there in the GOP? What are they going to do?
Well, this plan that they're proposing, and I confess I am not, I was up to speed on the Affordable Care Act when it first went in. You know, I co-authored a book with a medical doctor on it. So I was familiar with that thing and I was really up to speed on the details. This stuff, I don't claim to be an expert on it. The big picture, my guess is this thing, it's sort of like there's this unsustainable system, this train wreck that Obamacare was that was just going to fall apart and they were either going to have to totally take it down or go to single payer. And the Republican plan, I think, is like 50% of Obamacare. And so maybe it will linger along for a few more years relative to what would have happened. They pushed back, you know, the day of reckoning, but it's still an unsustainable system. So the benefit of it is it's getting rid of the mandates, right? So it's not saying you have to buy health insurance as long as you're, you know, a person in certain income ranges or whatever, the way Obamacare did. But on the other hand, that's kind of what the only thing that would have made the Obamacare system work, right? If you're going to say that health insurance companies can't deny coverage to people if they have pre-existing conditions, then the only way to make it possible to stay in business as a health insurance company is to force healthy people to buy the product, like so that the risk pool includes healthy and sick people. And so the Republican plan, and this is kind of like what Trump was promising, why, you know, I don't think he even fully comprehended what he was saying. He was kind of saying, oh no, we'll keep all the good stuff like universal coverage, but we'll get rid of the mandate. And those two doesn't go together. You know, if you're going to say they have to give coverage to everybody, then you got to say everyone's got to buy it or else, again, the actuarially falls apart.
See, this is the thing I never really understood, right? Or maybe I did, but Obamacare splits the difference there, right? They by on one hand, some people's premiums go way up. And like you're saying, they have the mandate to force the young and healthy to buy insurance that they otherwise don't feel like they need or whatever like that. But also, the national government gives giant subsidies to the insurance companies to make up for the shortfall that happens anyway. So in other words, why couldn't they cut the mandate on the individuals and still just keep taxing us all to death and do it that way? Cover the insurance company shortfall that way.
Maybe you're asking what some people have been saying, that look at it. And so let me just paraphrase and tell me if this is what you're getting at. If the issue was there was this group of people who were uninsurable under conventional, you know, measures, and people want to do something about it, like this is an unconscionable, you know, the modern day and age, this kind of society we have, that we're just going to sit here and let these people who are born with something or develop some condition, they can't get health insurance, and with prices what they are, without health insurance, you know, that's you're done. And so to deal with that, yeah, one thing you could have just said, all right, why don't we just subsidize them? You know, we'll just see, okay, how much would their health care cost, because they're uninsurable, and we'll just directly subsidize them and tax the population. And if people think it's fair, we'll, you know.
Well, I didn't mean single payer. I meant taking the way I understand it. Under Obamacare, it's half the individual mandate and half other tax revenue that's given directly to the insurance companies as subsidies to them to make up for the money they're losing anyway, even with the individual mandate, right? So I was just saying, what if they just abandoned the first part and kept the second, where they just subsidize the insurance companies so that they don't take that hard of a loss on the pre-existing condition?
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, just to finish.
Not that that's my idea, but yeah. I was just trying to understand about what the Republican version of the Democrats'
right.
law
I got
is
you.
Here.
Yeah. So, but by the way, I wasn't saying like what about a single payer. I just meant like directly paying for that small group of people, just like with Medicaid.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like expanding Medicaid just for those people, even if they're not elderly. That would be the idea. But yeah. I think it just the numbers might not work out right, and for whatever reason, that was the big sticking point of what's happening right now. Is so yes, there was a provision, it was like called a risk sharing program, where to get the health insurance companies, and so this is part of what happened and why I think the initial effects of Obamacare were not as fully severe as the actual underlying logic would dictate in the long run, because initially, partly why health insurance premiums didn't skyrocket when Obamacare was first, you know, fully implemented. And so the fans of Obamacare were saying, see, look at you conservative critics warned that this was going to cause premiums to jump. And no, it's actually not so bad. But partly why that happened was, like you say, Scott, there was provisions that said to insurance companies, go ahead and set your premiums. But if you're way off, you know, if the, you know, the claims you have to pay now end up going way up more than you predicted, because, you know, now we're changing the rules of the game so much, it's hard to know. You can't rely on historical data because now we're changing everything. If you end up losing a lot of money because you didn't charge enough in your premiums, we, the federal government, will make you, we'll share that cost with you, and we'll reimburse you, you know, according to some formula. And then they were charging, they were saying on the flip side, though, if you overcharge, right, like suppose you make a lot of money, you know, you charge premiums higher than you needed to, well, then you're going to give that, you're going to share that with us. And so the question was that element supposed to be self-financing? In other words, suppose it turned out, as what did happen in practice, that the insurance companies on net said to the government, whoa, you owe us a bunch of money. And then was the government supposed to come up with that money somehow, because that wasn't funded in terms of the other provisions? And then the Republicans were digging their heels and saying, no, we're not paying that. And so the insurance companies then were like, holy crap, you know, that was the deal. You told us to go ahead and set our premiums, thinking if we were wrong, you were going to compensate us. And so now you're not going to pay. And so that's when a lot of insurance companies start saying, well, we're pulling out of these exchanges and this is crazy. And so that turned into a political fight. And, you know, are the Republicans just trying to ruin Obamacare by not making these payments? That was kind of the spirit of the legislation. So that's the kind of stuff that happened. So politically, no, there's no way, Scott, they would have flipped and gone the other way, because that's partly how, and probably it's true, they're partly doing for political reasons, just to make sure Obamacare failed. But also just in general, that would have just been a long way around, I think, the same thing, that if they just tried to do it through taxes and so on, that would have really, because the problem is, if you're saying nobody, people can choose on their own whether to buy health insurance or not, then why wouldn't you? And you're saying, but if you're sick, the insurance companies have to give you a policy at that point. Well, then rationally, why wouldn't everybody just say, okay, I'm never going to pay a premium until I get sick, and then I'm going to apply for health insurance. And so if people do that, then no amount of taxes that you levy on rich people is going to cover that, because that you've totally screwed up the whole market and insurance breaks down in that kind of case. Mm-hmm. It's like, say, you know, if the insurance market for automobiles said when you get into an accident, then you go and apply for automobile insurance, collision insurance. I mean, that, you know, say, oh, we're going to pay for it with taxes or whatever. That would be a crazy system. That would just break down. So I think the same thing here. For insurance to work, it's got to be that people are, you know, paying in the system without just gaming it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you would just turn into single payer at that point.
All right. Now, so the saying goes, the middle of the road leads to socialism. And we could follow this conversation to Medicare for all or whatever, as they try to push it, the single payer type thing. But, and in fact, I'd like to ask you about that. But first, is it okay if we go back a little bit? Because, you know, the presumption, the way that people talk about this, of course, is that, well, look at the previous system. The previous system before Obamacare is madness. You know, my wife has lupus. Well, she had health insurance when she came down with lupus. In fact, she had health insurance the whole time. They misdiagnosed her. But even when they finally diagnosed her correctly, you know, but she had it the whole time. Then she changed jobs and changed health insurance companies. And they just said, meh, you know what? Because the law was, the new company, if you change, as long as your payments are current, then it doesn't count as a pre-existing condition kind of thing, right? But the new company just said, nah, screw you, it is a pre-existing condition, so that's it. No more health insurance for you. So here comes bankruptcy. I read a thing the other day, this girl that writes for Wired or Boing Boing or whatever, I think it's Wired, yeah, one of them. She says, well, she came down with the breast cancer, and she had insurance. And as soon as she let them know, yeah, I got breast cancer, I need you guys to start helping me, they opened up a fraud case on her and said, nah, we think you probably already had cancer, and now you're trying to rip us off. Which you and I know that they know that they're lying, that she did not do that, but they just want to get out of it because they don't care. Why would they care? And it's not like the judge is ever going to take her side, right? So people go completely bankrupt. People just die. She wrote, I saw her little Twitter thing. She said the ladies that were also with her getting their chemo, a lot of them just died because they just ran out of money. There's nobody there to help them. And they weren't poor people. They were regular people. But breast cancer treatment's expensive. And once the insurance company screws you, you're a dead man at 40-something years old or whatever it is. That was the previous system. And you and I both know that, to hear a Democrat tell it, yeah, that's free market capitalism for you. And maybe it is. Bob, you know what? Free market capitalists aren't necessarily decent people, right? I trust the market, not them. But so then my question is, I bet that probably you have an answer like, no, this is Nixon's fault or something, that it wasn't the free market that set it up like that. It was the government that set it up like that. That's my bias, too. I'm sure that's right without knowing the answer. But you go ahead and tell me.
OK, sure. So you're right in that there are plenty of horror stories, and it's not that the system as of 2007 was great. And I think sometimes people who, you know, talk about the evils of Obamacare and government takeover of health insurance, they make it sound like, oh yeah, there was this laissez-faire, beautiful system in 2007, and they're digging themselves into their own ditch there if they say that, because like you said, the system really was screwed up in 2007. It's not surprising that people thought, we need to change this. This is an unworkable system.
Yeah, they say it's the number one cause of bankruptcy in America isn't people running their business into the ground or something. It's their wife gets sick and their mm-hmm. whole family falls apart over it, you know?
Right. And you're also right that it was like the thing that if you went and worked for a large company a lot of times, then yes, they could, because you'd get part of their group plan and certain things would happen. But certainly if you were in between jobs, then like you say, there's even cases of if you switch companies, you know, maybe they would then try to balk at the other end. And so there's lots of examples like that. But you're also correct that system is not like, oh, that's just what the market outcome was. I mean, if you just think about it, you know, it's not due to the nature of insurance per se, right? It's not that, well, yeah, I can't drive right now. And well, why not? Oh, because I don't have auto insurance. Why? Oh, because I'm in between jobs. And you know how your employer gives you auto insurance. Like, people don't even talk like that. That would be weird to even talk. But yet we do say stuff like, oh, yeah, I can't get that elective procedure right now because I'm in between jobs and I don't have health insurance because, you know, I get it from my employer. And so you, if you try to understand like what, why is that, there is a history, you know. So just very quickly, to give two examples. So in during World War II, as you know, Scott, the government was printing money like crazy. That would have normally led made prices jump up. They didn't want to let that happen, so they imposed wage and price controls. But they, and so a firm who wants to bid away, you know, talented workers from other companies couldn't offer more money. That was illegal. But what they could do was offer benefits, like saying, oh, we'll pay for your health insurance. And so that was partly why that became just standard as part of, you know, company compensation packages. And then also the income tax code keeps this in place where it's standard for people, you know, with nice 9-to-5 jobs to get their health insurance from their employer, because from the employer's perspective, if they pay for your health insurance, like for you or your family, that's tax deductible to them, right? That's just like part of their compensation. That's a cost of business. But you as the employee, if they gave you just money, then you got to report that on your taxes. But the way the tax code is right now, if they pay for your health insurance, you're not taxed in kind on that. And so so it's a way to minimize taxes, especially if it's like, you know, a high productivity employee who would have gone and paid for an expensive health insurance plan anyway. You know, that's like a way of reducing their taxable income by 10 grand or 15 grand or whatever the number is. So that's partly why the system is how it is and everyone's dependent on their employer for health insurance. But I think the big thing in all this is, why is health care so expensive? And there, it's, I think it's because of the FDA and all these, you know, licensing and stuff at the state level, where the government is just artificially keeping it very expensive to get health care, which is why everyone thinks, oh, I need to have health insurance in order to pay for it. I think that's part of the problem, is people are mixing the terms health care and health insurance as if they're interchangeable and they're different things.
Yeah. All right. Now, in fact, I wonder if you ever read that thing a couple of years ago, maybe by, remember that he used to have his own magazine, Brill's Content. I don't think it's, I don't know if it's his own magazine anymore, but this guy, I forget his first name. Is it Stephen Brill or something? He does always really long, long form work. And this one was all about, basically, at any hospital you go to, there's the bill and the official menu, but there's also, it's like In-N-Out Burger, where there's like the secret menu or whatever. And if you look at that, then it's a whole different other level of prices that the law mandates. You know, all of this stuff is completely lower. Anyway, he was just delving all into why prices are so distorted. Although, healthcare can be really expensive, right? Like if we just had, you know, a real free market, some of these treatments would be extraordinarily expensive that maybe even upper middle class type people wouldn't ever be able to afford some of these things without insurance, right?
That could be the case, but it would certainly help things. And so you're right. There's and I don't know if this is what this guy was getting at, but people can certainly, if you go up and you're trying to get a procedure done, and they tell you how much, well, for one thing is they won't tell you ahead of time how much it costs. Like there was some thing I heard on the radio when I was in Nashville, some, you know, woman who worked for a radio station was pregnant, and she was kind of doing like a story, an expose on healthcare costs. And she called around, I'm making these numbers up, but this is the spirit of, she called some like 8 local hospitals and said, yeah, if I have a regular, you know, vaginal birth and all this stuff and no complications, what are we talking about here? How much? And only one place would even give her a number. The other places said, no, absolutely, we're not going to tell you a number, because then, you know, if it comes up being more expensive, you're going to get mad at us. Only one would even give her a figure. So it shows this is not a normal market. Like, people aren't treating it like that. And so, the health care providers know that. And so when you go and you get a bill, if you say to them, okay, but I'm actually going to write you a check, you know, then it could be a smaller amount, because they know, yeah, to say that we're going to send this guy a bill, they might not pay it, it's going to go to debt collection, or we're going to argue with the insurers and da da da. Whereas if you're literally paying us in cash, you know, right now, then yeah, we'll give it to you for less. So even that right there kind of shows this is a weird market where they have to inflate the cost on their end, because they know a bunch of people aren't ever going to pay it, or they're going to pay it, you know, through debt collection years later. So it's this vicious cycle where it breaks down like that. But I think part of the problem though, Scott, is we've gotten to the point where insurance, you know, quote, pays for everything, or best of deductible. So people made this analogy before, but it's worth repeating. If what happened in auto insurance is like what happens here, then every time you went and got an oil change, your auto insurance would cover that, right? Whereas no, the reason you have insurance is for catastrophic expenses. So yeah, the reason you would have health insurance is not to go get a checkup or even some minor thing. But like you said, if you get cancer or, you know, some real catastrophic thing, that's the point of having health insurance. And it, everything would all around would be a lot more affordable if that's really the way the system worked. But that isn't how it works right now. It's where health, you know, the health insurance companies are the ones dealing with the doctors, and the patient is treated like this annoying nuisance who's over here bothering everybody when really the patient's supposed to be the customer.
Yeah. You know, this reminds me of, I'm almost certain this is from Harry Brown's Why Government Doesn't Work, because as soon as any industry gets in bed with the government, it makes the focus the profits of the supplier rather than the good of the consumer. Basically, it turns everything around into a basically a political football where the organized masses, I mean, I guess the best the organized masses could do would be like the AARP or something like that. But that's nothing compared to the lobbying power of the hospital companies, the pharmaceutical companies, the insurance companies, right?
Yeah, and you might remember when the Affordable Care Act, you know, Obama first gets elected and he's coming in and he was making a push for this, the I don't know if it was the pharmaceutical companies or like the healthcare co-ops or whoever. I don't remember which actual group was doing it, but they were funding like anti-Affordable Care Act commercials. And then that just all went away. And I believe it was because there was like backdoor meetings where, you know, the people crafting legislation told them, you know, look at all these provisions we're giving you. If you drop these, you know, these ad cam, we'll change the numbers. Because look at, they were passing a law saying every American had to buy their product, you know?
Right.
So,
yeah,
so that's the
you
way
know, Marcy
like
Wheeler,
the, yeah.
Marcy Wheeler, who's a progressive, you know, Empty Wheel on the internet there. She's, you know, obviously not a libertarian like us, whatever. And she was just looking at it and saying, this is a bad deal. This is, I forget the lady's name, but it was the most powerful lobbyist for the, I think for the insurance companies. Could have been for the pharmaceutical firms, but I think it was for the insurance companies, was like the lead crafter of the legislation. And she was in charge of the crafting of the legislation.
Yeah, and that's...
I hope I'm paraphrasing Marcy right there. I think I am.
I'm not familiar with her particular work, but I mean, yes, I've seen many progressives who, you know, really are... Like people who are fans of single payer or something and look at Europe and say, oh, why don't we do something like that? A lot of them were outraged by what happened with this stuff. And, you know, and they
well,
could
this
say,
wasn't even that. I don't even think she was saying necessarily single payer would be better, but just, hey, look, this is Wall Street's bill, or this is, you know, the corporate bill. This is not some democratic, utopian, whatever you imagine Obama's going to do for you type of thing, you know? That's what she was saying to the other progressives.
And this is something that, you know, it when I was younger, like, so people, I know you're audiences probably doesn't fall for this, you know, being anti-war and so on. But yeah, it's, I think there's still a lot of young, certainly conservatives types, you know, who don't like the government messing with big business, you know, bit, and they're naive and they don't understand that big business actually benefits a lot of times from these regulations. You know, things like Sarbanes-Oxley and whatever, like if you were a big financial firm, you might benefit from that because having all these extra accounting mandates and whatever, you can better afford to hire a bunch of new accountants and tax attorneys, whereas, you know, a competitor who's only half your size, that fixed overhead cost of having that much more, you know, personnel is going to hurt them more than you. And so, you know, the Ayn Rand's idea of like big business is the most persecuted minority or whatever, that's not really accurate. And to understand the way this works is, yes, that big business is an alliance with big government. And so it's this perverse outcome where, you know, progressive or certain politicians will cater to progressives saying, oh, this stuff's going to clamp down on business and the rich, and it's going to help the poor and, you know, minorities and underprivileged and whatever. And yet, and then the, you know, the conservative types oppose it because, oh, you're meddling with big business or whatever, the free market, rah, rah. And yet in practice, it's the worst of both worlds, where it's actually giving handouts and favors to the big business interests, and it's hurting poor people, and it's also intervening in the economy. So,
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. If you're so smart, then how's it supposed to be? You know, I know a guy, real good guy that I used to know. I guess I don't really know him anymore, but good guy I used to know, who his daughter was born with all kinds of medical problems. And he's, hey, without Medicaid, I guess it was Medicaid, Medicare, without Medicaid, she'd have been dead. Simple as that. The reason she's not dead is because of Medicaid. So who is going to take care of that? He's a poor guy. And maybe that's his fault that he didn't go right into business right out of high school or something. But anyway, He's some hippie. His daughter's born sick. Who's going to help him? Nobody?
Okay, so again, I mean, I don't, obviously don't know that guy's particular circumstances, but the reason, I mean, people need to realize this is not a normal market when it comes to health care. Look at, like, why isn't it the case with health care that costs don't keep coming down, right? Like with computers or something, the computers keep getting cooler and cooler, and the price either goes down or it goes up slightly. But when you do stuff like how much am I paying per megabyte of, you know, RAM or whatever, it's the cost is plummeting. It's not even close. And yet with medical care, the prices seem to be going up. So why is it the competition doesn't work? But it, where you do see it is in things like LASIK surgery or whatever, or like cosmetic surgery, something that you might go into the mall to get done. Those types of things, prices are getting cheaper, right? And it does seem like a normal market. And so I think that that's a, you know, evidence that there's something screwy with this, you know, where there's big insurance companies and the government's involved and big hospitals and whatever, that something is wrong and there's not normal market forces and there's not regular competition. So I think, you know, how do we get to that kind of a framework? And there's lots of things that could happen. So again, things like the FDA, that's why, you know, these prescription drugs are so expensive. It's literally illegal for people to compete with it. These companies have to spend millions. There's, depending on how you frame it, right now for a drug company to bring a new major drug to market will cost $1 billion with a B dollars of testing and so forth. So I think drugs are overprescribed, by the way. I'm not saying that's the panacea, but I'm just saying when people are trying to say, like, why are these things so expensive? Well, that's part of the reason. There's, you know, rules against importing stuff from abroad and whatever. And this thing like limiting doctors who can come in, certain, you know, licensing boards and whatever. This is just normal. I mean, this is like the guild system, right? That they're artificially limiting competition in order to raise rates. And so there's lots of examples where it's artificially crippling competition and you're not having normal market forces. So I think that's part of how you would get out of this logjam is to allow competition and try to get some semblance of a market going to have competition.
Okay, so that's a great first part of the answer, and I think you're right. And I remember driving a cab and having a doctor in the back of my cab, and he was a free market guy, not because of any Austrian economic schooling he'd gotten, but he was, the way he framed it to me was, look, me and my doctor friends, we're freaking doctors, okay? We can run a business, and if we were just free to do it our way, prices would be way cheaper, everything would be fine, whatever. He believed that, okay? And he made sense the way he explained it to me. But still, even then, price is cheap. Poor people don't have any money. Something bad happens to them. They can't afford the insurance, or they didn't already have the insurance. And everybody, you know, I think on the right and the left, especially, you know, Democrat types, you just want to let them die. That's their answer. And that's their answer to your problem. And then their answer to your problem is, government's got to do it. Of course, the national government has to be the safety net. Otherwise, poor people just die. And so even if we had an almost completely free medical system, still, what do you do about people who are poor, people who, you know, their little baby's got cancer, whatever, nightmare horror story kind of thing about it? What do the libertarians do about that, Bob?
Okay, so I think, you know, we have to go on the moral issue and then say if what the person is saying is it's moral to take money at gunpoint from some people in order to spend it on things that I think are more important than what they were going to spend it on, I would object and say, no, you can't do that. That's not allowed. Now, you know, continue with my moral framework. If there are people who are literally dying because they can't afford something, and there's other people who are rich and they have six mansions and what have you, then I would say, yes, they have a duty to help the poor, you know, not legally speaking, but morally, ethically, and they should go ahead and do that. And we can look, you know, back in like the 1930s and stuff, there were plenty of doctors who would go and make house calls and things and do stuff for the indigent. And this is still, even to this day, that's part of, you know, people doing things pro bono. And so if the government, you know, the government doesn't magically have money to give to people that it didn't first take from somebody else. So it's not that we have more resources to help poor people if we do it through the federal government. It's actually the opposite, that there's money, there's more money lost through bureaucracy, and just having high tax rates, you know, discourages work efforts. So there's less to take in the first place. So if the government got out of the business of taking care of millions of people who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford health care, then the public would have that much more money that they could channel through private philanthropic efforts. So I think those mechanisms would be there. But ultimately, if somebody says, no, but suppose it doesn't, I want to reserve the right to take money at gunpoint from this guy and give it to this person over here for health care.
Yeah.
If you're putting, you know, backing me into a corner, Scott, I'm going to say ultimately, no, I don't agree with that, that's stealing.
There's one more refuge of this argument, though. I'm thinking of leftists I've argued with on Twitter a little bit, and I try not to get too far into it because I really only care about the wars and stuff because I'm healthy. It's not my issue. But their answer to what you just said is, yeah, but billionaires. So, you know, what if we just had the only income tax bracket was people who, it wasn't even income. Anybody who's sitting on more than $1 billion worth of stock in anything, we're taxing your ass to make sure poor people don't go without, you know, what should be pretty cheap and available healthcare. Then that way it's not immoral, because once somebody's a billionaire, and I think there are clearly exceptions to this, but I know you're free market enough to know that most billionaires are on welfare anyway. As Bill Gates said, hey, we should have high income taxes on all us billionaires, because each and every one of us got rich off of the infrastructure of this great country that this national government administrates for us. And what he means is there's Windows on every machine in D.C. and that he's rich because of them to a large degree. So how about we just hold them at gunpoint and take just enough? I don't mean eat the rich and dissolve all capital and consume it like a Maoist until we all starve. But how about just enough? We just rob them just enough. Fair
okay.
enough?
Yeah. Let me just say as a broad point here that what I'm always advocating, of course, is what I think the best vision of a free society would be. And so if somebody wants to say, okay, yeah, but what you're talking about is not going to happen, and so let's be more realistic and say something politically plausible, that's fine. If I were like
a
senator.
It is apples and oranges, though. You're right. And I'm with you. I'm for not having a national government whatsoever, even a state government. So who's going to tax who?
So I get that what I'm saying might seem, you know, pie in the sky or whatever. People say, yeah, but that's not really. So, but you know, if I were a senator or something, and then, you know, maybe you could say, okay, but I want you to restrict your discussion to something that's going to happen next Thursday, not, you know, some far off thing. So I get that. But again, here I'm just this libertarian economist author, and we're having this hypothetical conversation. So that's why I'm, you know, I have the liberty to talk about what the optimal, you know, thing to do is. So in your case, yeah, I certainly wouldn't cry crocodile tears over if the government went and took money from some guy who was a billionaire, especially like some guy who's made money off defense contracts or something, and took some money from him to give it to somebody else so that their kid wouldn't, you know, die. Obviously, I'm not going to be up at night wrestling with the horrible injustice of that outcome, because like you said, you're basically just taking money back from someone who stole it from taxpayers in the first place in order to fund the death machine. So I get that. I don't want to come off like I'm saying it, but I'm saying, no, the ideal outcome would be to not have these billionaires who become billionaires through state contracts and such, and the money you'd save that way. The other thing too is there's not that many billionaires. I mean, you really couldn't replace the current system just by taking money from them to pay for it. Like, you really would have to switch over to a system where it was largely, you know, self-sufficient if all you were going to do was to tap into billionaires and pick their pockets in order to fund these programs.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the whole worst part about all of this to me, is that the more any of us in the society are the demand for the government supply, then they could never do without the income taxation the way that they do it, which includes extorting to the limit the poorest people, even, right? It's not like they only tax billionaires. They tax everybody. And then the system, and I know I'm off on a tangent now, but any libertarian knows what I mean about this. Hell, any American ought to know what I mean about this. The system of income taxation, they're basically making it a crime for you to earn anything. And you have to then confess to how guilty you are of every cent that you earn, so that then they can take as much of it as they can. And you can't lie about how good you did. You must confess to how good you did, you criminal, and pay up your fine for achieving anything. Makes no sense whatsoever. Just makes no sense whatsoever. Not, I'm not arguing for a fair tax or any kind of thing like that, but I'm just saying, the fact of income taxation in America is like the Twilight Zone. It's completely crazy that anything that calls itself a free society has income taxation. And yet, like you're saying, you can't just tax the billionaires. You have to tax everybody in order to pay everybody. And that's the system we've let them stick us in, basically.
And one point is, you're right. That's funny that, you know, in other areas, you can't be compelled to testify against yourself.
Right.
That's what. But yeah, this is the one area where you do have to. And if we catch you making a mistake, then you're getting in extra trouble. You're right, Scott. And this thing, again, just for your, especially, I understand that there are probably listeners you have who really are skeptical of, you know, big businessmen, and they have horror stories of actual real life insurance companies, not the stuff in my fairy tale land of yay free markets. I get that. I really do. But also, by the same token, with that hard nosed cynicism and realism, you got to say the same group of people in Washington who have no trouble bombing foreign kids, do you really want them in charge of your health care? Right? It's the same group of people. And so they don't all of a sudden switch to become completely moral and trustworthy and concerned about the health of the, you know, the poor people when it switches to domestic affairs. And so for people who are very anti-war and don't trust the U.S. government when it comes to foreign policy, again, why would you want them in charge of whether your, you know, daughter gets a kidney transplant? If we can remove, you know, the separation of healthcare and state is a good idea.
Yeah. All right. Now, so on that, though, isn't there a difference between socialized healthcare and a single payer system where all the doctors still work for private companies and everything like that? It's just now basically everybody has a Lone Star card or whatever it is for, you know, for food stamps. Now it works for your doctor too. And is, no?
Yeah, you're right. There's various levels of intervention.
I guess how much freedom are the people of Texas giving up, or the people of the U.S. giving up, if we have the government as the single payer out of the pot rather than insurance company middlemen?
So, You're right. There's various levels. And yes, single payer is not literally the same thing as completely socialized medicine, in the sense of if all the doctors work directly for the government, that would be even worse, as you say, because
that would be the ultimate nightmare. Right. My God, can you imagine? I'm sorry. I just saw blood. Sorry, go ahead.
So you're right, because the virtue, even if the government were paying for it, as long as there was still the doctors, like you say, who worked technically in the private sector, although all their contracts would come from the government or their payments, but at least there would be some competition among it. And even though the government wouldn't care about containing costs as much as any individual private insurance company, nonetheless, you know, if one company's coming in and say, oh, we'll cover people this amount, and the other one's undercutting them by 30%, you would think that would contain costs more than just flat out, no, everyone's literally working for the government, and it's truly, you know, a government operation, so anyway, you're right that there are levels there, and we should be more precise in our language. And I think you're onto something there,
when you're saying that even in the case of just so-called single payer, ultimately there will be a government bureaucrat, if not an insurance company bureaucrat, saying, no, this is too much, too soon, or whatever, and overruling your doctor.
So it's ironically the benefit is also the scary thing about that. They would contain costs more, but you're right. The problem with single payer is ultimately, you know, the government's in charge. And, you know, Sarah Palin, of course, with her death panels thing, and you could say that was a rhetorical stunt, and it probably was. But it is the case that right now we have the technology. You can prolong life. You know, you can spend lots of money keeping somebody who's 83 alive for another year. And then so choices do have to be made to say, are we going to spend an extra $60,000, you know, keeping this guy who's in constant pain alive for 6 more months? Or are we going to use that money to give prenatal care to, you know, 50 kids or something? And so there's no way to answer that question, I don't think, definitively, except to say, let's leave it in the hands of the individuals involved with their resources. And so when you start letting government officials make that decision, and it, number one, they're going to make mistakes. even if they mean well. Mm-hmm. But number two, that gives an extra dose of arbitrary power to these people. So, you know, you might be afraid to criticize the government if they have the ability to deny your aunt her kidney transplant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and now these decisions are made by insurance company bureaucrats, but then again, I mean, instead, but then again, only under the law and to the degree that the law will allow, right? So somewhere, if they say, well, we want to unplug your grandma or we want to deny this kidney, there's a law in your state that says when they can say that and when they can't already, right? Or a court decision, right?
I think that's correct. I'm not really an expert on the laws, but even there, though, Scott, ultimately, the family, if they wanted, if they had the money, they could pay it themselves. You could say, well, it's really a high cost. But under single payer, I mean, by definition, single payer, if that means the government pays all medical bills, then you don't have that option, right? And in some countries, there's like a bifurcated thing where they call it single payer, but yet it's allowed to have, you know, you can opt out and pay a doctor, you know, on the side. Mm-hmm. But in some places, even that's not allowed because they don't want to have like two tiers of healthcare for rich and for regular people. Mm-hmm. And so it's literally illegal. Like you can't pull a doctor aside and say, hey, you know, can you treat me next? You know, can you move me up in your schedule and I'll give you this payment on the side? Like that's not allowed. And so I'm saying in that kind of a framework, then you really are ultimately dependent on, you know, these power brokers. Whereas in the current system, even if the insurance company says, sorry, we're not paying for grandma anymore because she's in comatose, technically if the family could come up with the money, they could do it too. It's not like the right. insurance company can kill your grandma. They can just right. say, we're not paying for it anymore.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know what? I think I'm probably out of questions and I don't know if I ever even had any good ones here. Is there anything I'm really missing on this healthcare debate that you think people need to understand better?
So I get one last thing I want to say again, just to make sure people understand the numbers and what's flying around here. Besides the claim that, oh yeah, this GOP plan is going to just kill thousands of people. And we talked about why I think that's misleading. The other thing is to say, oh, this is just a tax cut for the rich. The studies that this was more for the House bill that came out, but the studies coming from like the Urban Institute, right? So this is not, you know, a right wing outfit. This is, you know, pro ACA when they were trying to show how, you know, much this was going to help the rich people. Yes. The bulk of the benefits in terms of these tax reductions that were repealing what happened under Obamacare were accruing primarily to the wealthy because the Obamacare tax hikes were, you know, hitting the wealthy the hardest. So that's going to happen. But even their own study, I just look at the numbers, we're showing this was going to be a tax cut for 55% of American households. Okay. What the GOP House bill was. So just you keep that in mind. It's actually not correct, the framing, to make it look like, oh yeah, they're just giving tax cuts to this handful of rich people, and then millions of people are literally going to die. That both ends of that claim are misleading at best.
Mm-hmm. But they are going to be ending the increased subsidies for the states that chose to expand Medicaid. Is that it? Or is it Medicare? I'm sorry, I screwed up.
Yeah, they're changing the formulas around. So yes, I think they're like, if you, in terms of projections over time of how much would be paid.
But they're not just ending it. They're not
right.
They're not.
I believe it's still. Though. Yeah, I think it's still going. I think it's just one of those deals where the rate of growth is going to be cut. So yeah, if you look ahead to fiscal year 2030, how much is the government going to get? It's a cut from that level. The other thing is, which depending on your perspective is either good or bad, is they're instead of just giving them the subsidies, they're giving them like block grants and telling the states, here's the money, you do with it what you want. So if you like experimentation and stuff, you might say, oh, this is good. Maybe now some states will, you know, hit upon ways like introducing co-payments or something to limit, you know, put change incentives so people aren't going to the hospital or going to the doctor for frivolous things, whereas other people are concerned that, oh, wait a minute, if now we're leaving it to the states that are more cruel, you know, are going to be real stingy with the money, whereas I would feel more comfortable if the federal government was directly, you know, paying people. So that's kind of what people are talking about now here, that they're it's going to be less reimbursement through those programs relative to the status quo, but also they're changing the way they're doing it. It's more like they're just giving them a pile of money and saying, you do with this what you want. We're not going to dictate exactly the formula of reimbursement that you should use.
Yeah. All right, I get you. All right, let me ask you one more thing before you go. Is it okay?
Yep.
And I'm sorry because I didn't mean to keep you this long, but you're interesting.
Well, that's good.
So listen, the bubble popped in, what, 92 or 93? Or, oh, yeah, it was 92 because that was what really helped cost George Bush Sr. his spot. And then in 99, the bubble popped. Remember that? 99, mm-hmm. 2000, NASDAQ first, then the Dow. And yep. And then was 2008, right there before the election, bubble popped, massive crash, stock market problems. And then monetary expansion ever since then. Got to stimulate this economy to prevent the whole thing from cratering, you know, and all that. So now the question, of course, for you is, when's the next crash, Bob?
In the future, but...
I know you don't like answering that question, but I like hearing you explain why you don't like answering it.
Well, because if I'm wrong, then I look wrong, and why would I stick my neck out? But no, the obviously, you know, as an Austrian economist, you can't predict the future and things like that. Let me just clarify, though. If you're looking at the Fed's balance sheet, you know, like how many assets do they hold and how much new money do they, quote, create out of thin air in order to buy assets, that actually has been constant since like mid to late 2014. All right. So Ben Bernanke, from 2008 onward was a mad inflator. But then Yellen came in and kind of oversaw, you know, a return to just a holding pattern. And so I think, I don't have any proof for this, but just in terms of their policies and the rhetoric and whatever, I kind of think that they realized they kept doing rounds of QE every time the stock market would falter. And then I think they realized, okay, we can't let the world believe that that's what our game plan is, because the dollar will just crash. And so they brought Yellen in to try to, you know, ease back to it. You know, she's hiking rates very tepidly, but the Fed has not created new money in that colloquial sense of the term since 2014. And the dollar has actually strengthened against other currencies. So to answer your question, Scott, I don't know about timing per se, because partly if investors looked at the situation the way I do, we already would have had a crash. Mm-hmm. So the question is, you know, are they just wrong or is it that I'm wrong? But I think Europe's going to have a crisis first. I think their banking system is seriously screwed up, like Italy especially. They've made a lot of loans that are non-performing, and I think it's just like the ECB is kind of keeping them afloat, especially if the EU itself starts unraveling. I think you're going to see a financial crash there first, and then only later will it come and hit the U.S.
Hmm. All right, so I'm thinking of, you're reminding me of, I'm pretty sure it's the chapter on the boom and bust cycle, the business cycle from For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard. So this would be, especially for people who are new and curious about this issue, Austrian economics and central banking and the boom bust business cycle. This would be a good intro to it. Also, there's what has government done to our money in the case against the Fed and all that. But if I could paraphrase from that chapter a little bit here, I think what he says is that they always try to just barely prick the bubble and slowly let the air out. And yet, no, that doesn't work, dude. It pops every time. Maybe, you know, there's a delayed effect. But once they stop inflating because, they know there are limits on how far they can go, it always comes a crash. There is no holding pattern. The holding pattern is just between now and when it crashes. Because if you're not inflating, you're deflating. And deflating meaning mostly all the bad loans that were made with all the funny money start coming due and start getting canceled out when the people can't pay them back, right? So, in other words, I guess in question form, is that where we're at now then? Yellen has attempted to take a tiny needle and prick a hole in the inflationary bubble and let the air out slowly, but now we're just waiting for the other shoe to drop?
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. And remember, like with the housing bubble, you know, boom and bust, they did a similar thing. If you go look at what the Fed's, you know, interest rate decisions were in the 2000s, they brought them down to 1%, you know, as of, I think it was June 2003, held them there for a year. Then from June 2004 onward, it was like every time the Fed met, they would hike by like 25 basis points. So if you look at a chart of it, it looks like a little staircase going up. So yeah, it's not like they dropped rates that blew up a housing bubble and then they jacked rates way up and that crashed things. And man, why aren't you guys a little bit more careful in what you did? If you were more gentle, maybe. No, they were trying to be gentle. They were trying to do a, quote, soft landing and just raising rates slightly. And again, we still had that crash as we know. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right, Scott. That's what they're trying to do here. That's why they're raising rates so tepidly. And also the other difference too is the way the Fed has been raising rates since Yellen's in there now, it's not the conventional textbook mechanism that your listeners might have learned, you know, if they had to take a macro class or something, where Yeah, so to lower rates, what? The Fed buys assets, it creates money, buys assets, that pushes rates down. And then to raise rates, you know, the textbook thing is, oh, you would do the opposite. The Fed would sell off assets that would suck money out of the system, and so that ends up raising interest rates. That's not what they've been doing. The way the Fed lately is raising rates, they're not selling assets off. They're not sucking dollars out of the system. What they're doing is they're increasing the subsidy they're giving to banks to keep their money parked at the Fed rather than making loans to their customers. So that's how they're making the equilibrium interest rate rise, is because the Fed's saying, hey, well, if you keep your money parked here, we'll pay you now 75 basis points. And so why would any bank lend to anybody else for less than that? Because the Fed's got guaranteed money. Mm-hmm. So there's that element too, that I think that's partly why you haven't seen the normal thing you'd expect once they start tightening, is because the Fed's not really reducing the amount of dollars in the system or selling off assets. They're just increasing the subsidy they're giving to the commercial bankers.
Yeah. So now I'm reminded of what Robert Higgs says about the 1920s, that, you know, I guess the real worst of the bubble was cranked up starting in 1927. I hope I'm paraphrasing the man right. I'm sure you know better than me. Hell, he may have been paraphrasing you. You Bobs. But I think the way he says is the real worst of the bubble came in, started in 1927, but really all through the 20s, they'd been inflating and inflating and inflating, but it didn't seem like there was high price inflation, because what was happening was, as the Austrians, I think, say, it's only relative, right? So the prices should have been falling with all the new advances in technology and distribution and everything else that were going on in the roaring 20s. But the prices were pretty much staying the same when they should have been falling. And so people didn't realize it was a bubble, but it was only a bubble not because prices were going high, but it was just because the costs were going low and creating a bigger margin that way. And then, of course, the bubble got really out of control 27 through 29 when it finally popped in, kind of thing. But so I wonder if that makes sense. If I have that right, first of all, I guess. And then if that makes sense kind of as a metaphor here too, where, I mean, hell, I see my wife's grocery, you know, the grocery bill, and it's pretty high. I don't know. There's some price inflation. Maybe they say it's lower than I think it is, but maybe in relative terms, 1920 style, it really is a lot worse than any of us see.
Yeah, so that's a great point, to just make sure people got that. So and this is one of the distinctions between, like, the monetarists versus the Austrians, right? So some people say, like, why do you call yourself an Austrian? Aren't you just like a free market school? And aren't you like the Chicago guy? And in the 20s, yeah, like guys like Irving Fisher, he thought the Fed was doing a great job and thought that, you know, they had paved the way for prosperity as far as the eye could see, because, like you say, Scott, prices were very stable. Like, if you looked at, like, the consumer price index or whatever, you know, analog they used at that point, it looked like prices were pretty stable through a large portion of the 1920s. So if that's what you thought the measure of stable, neutral monetary policy was, the Fed's doing a bang up job. But also, as you say, the 1920s, like you said, they're called the Roaring 20s. There were, like, really large tax rate reductions, and Calvin Coolidge was real tight fisted and kept running a surplus and so on. So the government was real lean at that point, and private business exploded. People were getting, you know, radios and things like that, and it was a lot of electrification and so on. There was a huge transformation in the U.S. economy, and yet prices were stable. So what should have happened if the money supply had been fixed is that things would have gotten cheaper, and that's the way consumers would have noticed, oh yeah, we're actually a lot wealthier now because my paycheck can buy a lot more stuff now at the store. Whereas, you know, that you didn't see that. So by the same token, I think that's partly what happened this time around, that prices, there actually was a period in 2008, like the official CPI and all that stuff in the fall and winter of 2008, prices were literally falling. You know, how they would come up and say, oh, what's the inflation? There was literally price deflation in that sense. And then with all the, you know, inflation of the money supply that got put onto it, they turned that around. Also, things like, I know some of your listeners might not like the practice or whatever, but like the hydraulic fracturing, you know, fracking and so on, there's been a huge boom in the production of natural gas and crude oil in the United States the last decade, let's say. And so I think that, yes, had it not been for what the Fed did, gasoline would be really cheap right now. And so, again, I know some of your listeners, because of climate change stuff, might not like that, but I'm just saying certain things that would have happened had we not had this influx of trillions in new money would have manifested themselves. And so, yes, I think it is a bit of, yes, prices are higher, but only relative to, they would have been a lot lower after everybody clammed up and saved during the financial crisis because they, you know, are wanting to save and cut back on their spending.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, listen, I'll let you go. I'm sorry I kept you so long here, but I love talking with you. And I'm sorry to the audience. You know, as an economist, I'm a great anti-war guy. But the thing of it is, even though this isn't my specialty or anything, I do think that next to the foreign empire, the boom-bust cycle, the business cycle, as best as really only described by the Austrian school, is the most important thing in the whole world. It's at the root of all of the chaos in our economy and society, really.
It's the biggest thing in the world.
And so if people want to understand that, look up Bob Murphy and the business cycle theory, the Austrian business cycle theory, and that whole boom bust. Everybody learns about the boom bust from the time we're kids. We see it. The economy comes and goes. But why? Bob Murphy and his colleagues are the only ones who can really explain it to you correctly. That's the truth.
Well, thanks for saying that, Scott. And I like the way you just put it. It's a parting thought here is it's not so much, you know, in GDP growth could be higher and certain people would have a higher standard of living of 6.9%. You just said the chaos. And that's the thing is that's the way the state keeps control over people is by if you can't trust them, you know, your finances could go to crap or whatever. You lose your job. That's the way people get obedient and dependent on the central government is if the economy is really volatile. Nobody can plan and make their own decisions. And they ultimately say, oh, no, but we got to have the state there. They got to take care of us. They got to give us our food. They got to give us our health care because the state has systematically short-circuited all these other voluntary mechanisms. So people are utterly dependent on the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they got the whole story upside down, just as I learned it in elementary and or junior high school or whatever it was. When FDR came and created the central bank, that was the point of it, was to smooth out the boom and bust cycle that free markets cause. And when the truth is exactly the opposite, that's a pretty big light bulb to go off, I think. It always has been for me. It's at the root of so much. I mean, you think about all the independent family businesses, you know, that make just enough paycheck to paycheck to stay their own boss and run their own life and be independent as best they can. And then, oh, sorry, we got to pull the rug out from under the entire economy every decade or so. And whether it's deliberate or whether they just can't imagine that they're not doing the very best job they can being monetary scientists up there at the Fed is sort of beside the point, really. I've seen the boom. I'm only 40, or I'm very old. I'm 40. I've seen the boom and bust come and go, and I've seen it hurt a lot of people really bad. I think I've seen it hurt America overall really bad, you know? And of course, it's part of it is for financing the wars, right? You got to make the wars seem free rather than raising everybody's taxes. Hey, we're going to spend a few trillion dollars killing Iraqis. Instead, that's your time out of work is your cost of the Iraq war, right? But people don't put two and two together, so they get away with it.
Right, yeah. So the Fed came in right before World War One, and, you know, some people thought that wasn't a coincidence. They knew we got to have this thing up and running in order to finance U.S. entry into the war. So, yes, if for no other reason, people who are anti-war should also be against the Fed because that's the primary mechanism by which they can, you know, finance these wars that Americans wouldn't otherwise want to pay for.
Yep. All right. Well, listen, man, I'm sorry. I promise I let you go, and then I kept talking at you. But
okay, well,
it's great to talk to you
me.
Again, Bob. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
See
you. Too.
All right, you guys, that is the great Bob Murphy. He's at the Ludwig von Mises Institute at Mises.org. And he keeps the website consulting by RPM.com. That's his great blog and everything. And he's a research assistant professor at the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech University, way up there in the panhandle. All right. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Thanks, everybody, for listening to it. Check out the full archives, almost 4,500 of them now, going back to 2003 there at scotthorton.org. I run the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org, well, with a little help from my friends. And also you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. All right, thanks, guys.